Six Music.
This is a BBC Radio Six Music documentary.
About the shape I'm in, I can't sing, I ain't pretty, and my legs are thin. But don't ask me what I think of you, I might not give the answers that you want me to. Now when I talked to God, I knew he'd understand. He said, stick by me and I'll be your guiding hand. But don't ask me what I think of you, I might not give the answer that you want me to.
Welcome to The First Time with me, Matt Everett, on Six Music. This is the series where we meet some of the most influential and best-loved musicians around and look at the seminal first musical moments that shaped their lives and their careers. Today's guest is the man who lent his rhythm and name to one of the most successful bands of all time, Fleetwood Mac's Mick Fleetwood. Here Mick looks back over his whole career, which started during the 60s blues boom in London, where he met and found fame with the original Fleetwood Mac guitarist Peter Green, and it's the Green era Mac you just heard. That was their 1969 single Oh Well. We also talk about the ever-changing lineup of the band, and Mick also details the inter-band relationships and overindulgences that always threatened and sometimes succeeded in breaking the band up. I'm pleased to welcome on The First Time my guest this week, Mick Fleetwood. And I started by asking Mick, as I do with all my guests on The First Time, when was he first aware of music?
Goodness me. Well, in storytelling terms, I would really only be able to say that it was when I was very young, before we left as a family. I have a memory of my mother listening to the radiogram, and there was something, there was a very current hit, apparently, Little Red Monkey, diddle da dun da diddle da. It was all about some awful film that this guy used to walk along the street with an attaché case with a syringe and bump into the people that he needed to bump into. Like, oh, sorry about that. And, of course, in the... he was killing people.
That's pretty dark.
Very dark. And Little Red Monkey was the film music. I remember that.
Look at the monkey, funny monkey, little red monkey, acting so fidgety. Look at the monkey, funny monkey, little red monkey, cute as can be.
Where is his mama, papa, sister, brother, cousin, rest of the family? Little red monkey on his own, some very lonesome monkey is he.
Listen carefully, Dick and Jimmy, 'cause here is a job for you.
What is it?
If you get him into the zoo.
The zoo?
He'd do all of his tricks for you.
Was it quite a musical household?
Not tremendously in terms of no one was grabbing instruments and I wasn't learning to play anything or anything of that nature. But Mum loved the radiogram and would always clean to music. You know, that was cigarette cleaning. And I remember that, and that's how I started actually playing drums, which was me just hitting furniture.
Was that like big band stuff or...?
Whatever the pop music was in the 50s and stuff like that as a child, she would do that. And that's really about it. But they had good body language, both Mum and Dad, looking back on it. They knew how to move, you know. No wonder they had children.
And so who were your kind of first early musical obsessions? And you say you started to play the drums or just like hitting things. When did you start to have bands that you or musicians you kind of felt an attraction
Everly to? Everly Brothers, listening to on a crystal radio set at boarding school, Radio Luxembourg. When I first heard Buddy Holly, which was probably at boarding school for sure, I loved it. And inadvertently, I loved all of the Tom Tommy type stuff, which was really what I ended up doing later on with Bo Diddley and all of that stuff, Peggy Sue and all. Just all of that must have hit some chord with me. My dad, he used to do this pseudo military stuff on the pocket change in his pockets. And he would play glasses full of water with pencils at parties and things. That made me want to maybe be a drummer.
What's the first album that you owned?
I would say the first album would be Cliff Richard's In the Shadows. And before that, in truth, it was probably The Shadows.
Because they were a massive influence on so many other musicians. I think maybe they get a bit of a hard time.
I learned to play drums listening to Tony Meehan, the original drummer with The Shadows. And they were spectacular. Unbelievably great. And Cliff was great too. That was my first album, would have been The Shadows.
About gigs, can you remember the kind of first rock and roll gig that you went to? Seeing music, like, was again another thing is seeing music live in that environment is very different.
When I first came to London, I used to go off to Eel Pie Island and see the Stones playing, and when it was just like a band type of thing, it was a scene. It was super cool looking back on it. But I got weaned in London as a young musician playing at the Flamingo Club, where a lot of the early R&B, you know, Wilson Pickett and so forth would come down and play, and I loved all that stuff.
Wilson Pickett live must have been fantastic.
Unbelievable. They all were, you know, Otis I got to vicariously be around some of those people, little Stevie Wonder and stuff. We'd be doing our residency down the Flamingo Club. So a lot of music came through there, a lot of blues music came through. So as a young chap, when I first got here, when I was about 16, it was the early Liverpudlian bands.
Mm.
So it was like all that stuff happening, Cyril Davis, early blues, that happened to be where I wandered into. And musically, that was my home and really still is. I'm a blues drummer and that's what I'm sort of, to whatever avail, I'm good at doing that.
Who are your big blues reference points then, early on? Who were the people that you really fell in love with?
In terms of really locking down and really doing a lot of listening, I'm told that I can play a decent shuffle. That's about all I can do. It would be a chap that played on Live at the Regal and played with B.B. King for many, many years. It's Sonny Freeman, the drummer. Brilliant. That stuff is just killer. And there was a breed of drummer back then that just it's all to do with style, you know, and that was style.
What do you say we bring him on, ladies and gentlemen? The Regal Theater proudly presents the great B.B. King. Let me hear you.
She got real crazy legs. You upset me, baby. Yes, you upset me, baby. Well, I like being hit by a falling tree. Woman, what you do to me? Hey, she's not too tall. Complexion is fair. Man, she knocked me off the way she wear hair. You upset me, baby. Yes, you upset me, baby. Well, I like being hit by a falling tree. Woman, what you do to me? Yeah! She wear hair. You upset me, baby. Yes, you upset me, baby. Well, I like being hit by a falling tree. Woman, what you do to me? Well, now I'm tied to the scribe. Hard to start. Better stop now because I've got a weak heart. You upset me, baby. Yes, you upset me, baby.
Peter Green is obviously someone you'll always be associated with, and kind of that whole early 60s blues scene in London seems so vibrant and such a hotbed of talent. Can you right. remember first sort of meeting him and connecting musically?
Well, he came to audition for a band I was in with Peter Bardens, the keyboard player. Peter came down, had played, I think he'd played an audition out for John Mayall, when Eric thought he was going off to North Africa and changed his mind or something of that nature. And Peter came down, and I have to confess that I thought he didn't know much about chord structures and things.
Right.
He played very, very, very simply, right? And in truth, he'd only really fairly recently started playing the guitar. I'm the hugest Peter Green fan, right? So the irony was that I turned around to Peter Bardens, who was sort of the boss of the band, and said, I don't think he knows enough stuff. Because he did all that Booker T stuff, you know, like Steve Cropper lines and all the instrument. We were an instrumental band. And I said, I don't know if he's got enough chops, you know. Boy, was I wrong. I can tell you, having played with Peter for those years and know what he stood for and his ethic as a guitar player and the feel and his voice and God knows his songwriting talents, I totally take him as a template of what I call it. He's got it in no uncertain terms. So, and I owe him pretty much everything.
Those early Fleetwood Mac shows with, obviously, John McVie coming in, was it quite obvious early on that there was that kind of rhythm section link-up, that there was something a bit special with the band?
Early Fleetwood Mac?
Yeah.
Well, when Peter and basically me formed Fleetwood Mac back in the day, we wanted John to be in... It was called Fleetwood Mac.
Would make sense.
And I'd never played with John, apart from in John Mayall's Blues Breakers. There was definitely something. We bonded as mates, so much so that I was fired because we were both got loaded all the time.
Really?
Well, yeah, it's no secret. And two of us was just not on because we just drank too much. So John Mayall made the right choice, you know. Kept the gem, John and his bass playing, and gave me the boot, which I knew was coming anyhow. But out of that became Fleetwood Mac, which we did not know at the time, but that was the moment when we bonded as players and friends. So the duality of it is huge. You know, John's my best friend and he protects me musically.
Weirdly, Fleetwood Mac's first kind of hit was Albatross, 1969, yeah. Which isn't a traditional blues stomper by any stretch of the imagination.
Our first album, you know, which was called Peter Green's Fleetwood Mac, which he didn't want. He wanted just to be called Fleetwood Mac. That was a hit, but it wasn't a single hit. You're right. Yeah. Albatross was we came back from America and we suddenly landed at London Airport and it was like, wow, what happened? You got a number one hit, Albatross.
Can you remember recording the track? Because it is a very different, it still sounds unlike anything else, really.
It certainly was unlike a lot of stuff we were doing at the time. Yeah. And our audience, I think, had their noses put out of joint.
Really?
You know, we had hardcore blues fans and we weren't busting toenails, bending notes and stuff. But it was something that Peter had a huge regard. Santo and Johnny inspired that Sleepwalk and all those lovely songs. Was part of the training of Fleetwood Mac ever since, when you think about it, has been very unlikely. And the mishmash of styles that have come through the ranks of Fleetwood Mac, and somehow the band didn't literally go away, is sort of a miracle.
It wasn't until 1970 that Christine McVie joined as a proper full-time member.
After Kiln House.
Yeah. I mean, what did she bring to the group?
Oh, Chris brought songwriting, and we needed it badly. And John had his partner. In fact, she was already married to him when she joined Fleetwood Mac. So that was, for a while, was good, but also led probably to the reason that they broke up, which broke both of their hearts. She was a member of the rhythm section. She considers herself like, that's the deal. And that was the deal and the musical stage that was set and made that set a platform for Stevie and Lindsay.
You kind of, is scouted the right word? What were your first impressions of meeting them and kind of bringing them into the fold?
Huge. Again, getting back to it, I was just looking for a studio when Bob Welch was still in the band during one of our tour breaks. And some guy I met in the supermarket said, well, I'll come out now and look at the studio. That's how I met him.
Simple as that.
The engineer who turned out to produce the first Fleetwood Mac album, Keith Olsen, said, well, this is something I produced, and we made it in the studio, and we put up the two track and just to demonstrate the speakers. I listened and I said, well, good, see you. And apparently I saw Pretty Little Girl. They were doing demos. And he said, yeah, that's who did this. I said, oh, interesting, whatever. But it wasn't whatever, because when Bob left the band at the end of that tour a few weeks later, but I remembered Lindsay's guitar playing from just that one listening, which is really bizarre. Mm. But I think the it factor must have hit me again, and I phoned up the studio and, you know, that those tracks you were playing, the guitar player was really, really good, blah, 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 blah. And that's how they joined the band.
Which led
That's a lot more complicated than that, but not much. You know, Stevie wasn't asked initially. It was, we were after guitar player, and then they were joined at the hip, and it's both of us or nothing. Then we realized that all the lovely songs that we're writing together, and we didn't even play a note. Not one note was played. We made the decision on what they did on that album, which was sort of dangerous when I look back on it. But I was so convinced that they were very special.
That's a track called Stephanie from Stevie Nicks and Lindsey Buckingham's first solo album from 1973 called simply Buckingham Nicks, an album you still can't get on CD, weirdly. And that was one of the songs that Mick Fleetwood heard that made him recruit the duo for Fleetwood Mac.
Six Music. Six.
Her lover.
That's Rhiannon by Fleetwood Mac from their 1975 self-titled album, the first album to feature singers Stevie Nicks and Lindsey Buckingham, and released the year before they joined the band. It also became their first number one album, helped not inconsiderably by the huge success of that track. And this is the first time on Six Music with me, Matt Everett, and my guest this week from Fleetwood Mac is Mick Fleetwood. So what was it like after 9 albums to finally crack the lucrative and huge US mainstream rock market with that album? I asked him.
For me and John, we'd had huge, huge success with Peter in England, and then Peter left, and we had the carpet pulled away, creatively, commercially, success-wise, whatever way you want to look at, and we were in a mess. And then the second wave was Stevie and Lindsey, and we, as two people, had emotionally at least gone through something. So we weren't completely traumatized by it as an experience. However, having said that, you can't belittle the enormity of what happened to that. Was not even comparable. But slightly emotionally, we thought we were back in the saddle from whence we had once experienced.
Yeah.
But the other members of the band had no reference point at all.
Well, I don't think there's many musicians or people that can understand what it must be like when you have an album like Rumours coming out, when you have an album that's not an album, that's like a phenomenon.
I mean, it's like a freak.
40 million copies plus worldwide.
Yeah.
Can you remember people's reactions when it first came out? Because it is. It's one of those albums, isn't it?
It won't go away thing. People's reactions was that they loved our music, and we felt that our music was not like anyone else's music, and we were sort of probably quietly aware of that we were heard, and that was hugely gratifying. We just carried on with what we were doing. We managed ourselves, so we were able to, as crazy as we got, we really were quite grounded, even with all the stories of what you hear. But in truth, we really paid a lot of attention to just us and what we did.
Mm.
And we didn't have, it maybe looked like it in a way, but we were very unprotected. We weren't being told how great we were, and you got this, well, by the way, you got that, and do it. Because we did all that ourselves. So we weren't placated into the Elvis syndrome where you can do no wrong. And we were always objective and critiquing ourselves because we didn't have a manager. I was the nearest thing to it.
Go your own way.
obviously, as you said, the story's about the record, the two couples splitting and the substance abuse. I mean, how do you create anything in that circumstance? Well, let alone something as beautiful as that record.
Well, the substance stuff was, you know, we were young and beautiful. It really didn't have any encumbrament at all, which is an awful thing to say, because I'm not advocating that it was all super romantic, and because it ended up not being that. But we were in a drug culture, everyone, you know. We walked into a radio station, you know, they nailed you in the toilet and shared their drugs with you. It was just the way life was. You know, rock and rollers got like a sort of a bum rap, really, because we spoke too much about it or something, which was irresponsible, really, looking back on it. We weren't hampered by our lifestyle at all at that point. Mm. We were young, you know, like we could rock all night and do this and work really hard, and we stayed focused. And for us, that drugged thing, plus realizing that we didn't even really realize that we'd made cartloads of money. You know, we were really? Sort of naive for quite a long time. We said, oh yeah, we'll have one of those. We weren't sort of like, it wasn't like we can afford it. We just said, wow, this is cool. It was sort of sweet. And we were making music that we loved. All of that, looking back on it, was actually, no doubt, all the rock and roll stories of the lifestyle excesses, etc., and God knows, and all the drug thing. And it helped, in a way, distract us from the enormous amount of unhappiness mm-hmm. that surrounded us. We didn't realize that we were medicating ourselves, probably without realizing why. And looking back again, we were medicating and numbing ourselves out to some great extent.
She broke down and let me in. Made me see where I've been.
You made Tusk after that, which is, well, at the time, was kind of seen as being a brave, somewhat difficult record, which now everyone's like, oh yes, that's,
I love that album.
Yeah, that's
probably
your favorite
album.
Yeah, because it's a fantastic record, but it almost took a while for people to get
it. And kudos to Lindsey Buckingham. You know, I don't have memory of his read on it is a little bit sometimes too poignant in terms of, you know, no one understood what I wanted to do and stuff. I felt that I really did, but there was definitely a little reticence in the ranks about how, you know, there's only so many cardboard boxes you can play instead of drums, because you've got to, that is my only advice, is that I love all that stuff in terms of, but you're in a band, or you can't do it all yourself, you know. So a tremendous album, and he fought hard to make that. And I think if we hadn't have made a double album and done that album, my read being this sort of the mother hen, all costs, keep the band together, I think the band might have lost Lindsey a lot sooner.
Thank you.
There's something that you just said there in terms of being the person that brings the band together, the Big Daddy, you know, and it seems to be
Crazy Daddy.
that's been your role to kind of mm-hmm. bring the band together. Tango in the Night seemed to be very much your okay. We can do this. We come together mm-hmm. and we'll make it work. And you produce this another beautiful record.
Desperate Man. No,
yeah. I mean, is
no,
that?
I get it. I am in the middle of it, no doubt.
Why are you like that? Do you think?
Probably huge amounts of reasons, and if I had to sort of in good humor think of them, probably for sure, I'm a percussionist, I'm not a lead singer, and I'd be instantly going like, well, what am I going to do? And who do I play with? Well, how about the band that you are already in and you got your feet in a chunk of concrete that's, you know, enabling you to stand up and be in this band that's got that, oh, and it's got your name on it too.
So that's me on the cover.
So yeah, and why throw it away? I think that and my natural instincts to and having John at my side, go, okay, I think we'll give it another try. And I got in the habit of doing that. And I think I learned that when Peter Green left, it was hugely disturbing to me more than anyone, because I truly, truly adored Peter as a friend, as a human being, and as a mentor that was gave me the confidence to be a drummer, really, and said, you're okay, you know, it's okay what you do, it's really cool.
You're right.
Yeah, you're okay. And we made Fleetwood Mac happen, and I was there to decide. So when we lost him, it was hugely dramatic and traumatic for me. Hmm. So having got through that love affair, the healing of that became my model to repeat time and time and time again. And I think that's where it came from. And I found ways to handle not losing my band.
Looking out for love in the night so still. Oh, I build you a kingdom in that house on the hill. Looking out for love, big, big love. You said that you love me and that you always will.
Less than a year ago, the official line was Fleetwood Mac is not going to tour again.
That was my line.
How does it feel to be in the group again, going on tour and playing again? It must be fantastic. Well, what's changed from it's never going to happen again?
Well, in truth, that's not what everyone was saying. I said that in a magazine article for the first time, because I thought, and I'm the proverbial at all costs onward, forever onward, and this and that. And I was sitting there in Hawaii, and in truth, had my nose slightly put out of joint because Stevie delayed a decision, was that we were going to be working and doing our thing. And the boys in the band were slightly, whoa, we thought we were going out and doing it. And then we took a breath. But before I took a breath, I'd done this article right when it was fresh. And I just said, you know what? Actually, and I just heard this sort of news that everything was going to be delayed. And I went, I don't think it's going to happen. Having said that, Stevie was greatly disturbed because she was asked, like, oh my God, is that it for Fleetwood Mac? She said, what do you mean? So it actually worked out to be a very positive thing. But I was... That was part of my lesson learned, where I had no right to be all... Stevie has worked her buns off for Fleetwood Mac for so long, and I wanted to let go. And
I'm normally keeping it together, so this time...
So I did the proverbial thing that your best friend normally says. Why don't you just let her go, and then she might come back to you? So it was probably a version of that, and that resonated all around the planet from this big article that I did. So who knows? It may have had some reason where Stevie got so fed up telling people when, where, and how. She said, no, we're not broken up. And of course, we were not.
And a new album?
No new album. Myself and Lindsay, about 6 months ago, went in and created a calling card, basically, for Stevie. We wanted her to know that we want to make some new music. But we didn't go into it literally saying that. We just said, well, let's just do it. And he had some great songs. And so John and I flew over to LA. We had the greatest time, and we made some really good music. And that might become part of a long-term plan over the next year. We'll maybe finish out an album. I hope that there's a demand for it after we throw two or three songs out on the... internet. So it might become an album. I hope it happens.
And the last question that we ask everybody is, what's the last song that we should play? It can be one of yours, one of your friends from the past, present, or the future. Something you heard this morning or something you've loved since you were 6 years old.
I would say Sea Cruise.
Why that song?
Because I love the drumming on it and it swings like the clappers. But you dig it out.
We'll dig it out.
We'll dig it out.
It's good to speak to you. Thank you very much.
Cool.
Get to moving, baby, I ain't lying. My heart is beating. laughing. Baby, won't you join me, please?
This is BBC Radio 6
Music.
You can reach and you can grab it. You can hold it, control it, no, you can't bag it.
This morning from 11, Huey Morgan.
At 8, Radcliffe and Marconi.
Right now.
It's Chris Hawkins.